Now we look back at what led up to the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor 81 years ago today. Here's President Franklin D. Roosevelt speaking to Congress in the aftermath of the attack.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
We're going to dig into that conversation and that diplomatic history today and learn about a figure at the center of the story, the U.S. ambassador in Tokyo at the time of the attack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what led up to the Pearl Harbor attack? What do you remember hearing about it at the time, if you were around with us then, or from your parents or your grandparents? What questions do you have on this anniversary? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Kemper is a journalist and author of several books. His latest is called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Steve, welcome to Central Time. Do we have you there? There we do. Steve, let's start with the ambassador at the center of your story before he gets to this very difficult situation in Japan. Can you tell us a little bit about the career of Joseph Clark Grew?
Sure. He was born to Boston Brahmins, grew up on Beacon Hill, went to prep school at Groton, and then followed his father and brothers to Harvard. That was where the Grews went. And when he got out of Harvard, he was expected to go into Boston business or banking. He had no interest in those things at all. So eventually he ended up going into the State Department instead of going on to State Street. He served in 14 posts during his career. He was more or less a legend in the State Department because of his accomplishments and his post and what he had done. And that's why in 1932, when the Japanese invaded Manchuria, President Herbert Hoover decided to send our best man to the most difficult mission in the world at the time, Japan.
And let's talk about what he's walking into in Japan. Now, this is amazing. He gets word he's going to be the ambassador to Japan. He's on his way, you know, I think taking the train across the country to take a ship over to Japan. When news breaks, the Japanese prime minister assassinated by radical far-right members of the Japanese military. What was he in for with this appointment?
a roller coaster ride. He called it actually like he was living on a volcano. Japan was a mess. Before I started researching this book, I didn't have much idea about it. I mean, we all know about the 30s in Europe, Germany and Italy and so on. But this was a mystery to me, and it was fascinating. It was complete chaos over there. This wasn't the first assassination, or would it be the last? It was the second prime minister assassinated within 18 months. There were plots, conspiracies. There were internecine wars within the right wing. Some people were not right wing enough for other right wingers. There were patriotic societies that they called themselves patriotic societies that were essentially right wing groups that were intent upon overthrowing any cabinet that wanted to have closer relations with the Western nations. So Grew had a handful.
Oh, the amazing thing is reading your book, and I didn't really realize this so much. The first question is, who am I the ambassador to? Because you had the emperor, right, who is the ultimate, you know, acknowledged leader, almost a cult-like devotion to the emperor of Japan, and actually has no practical power to do anything. There's what looks like a civilian government with a prime minister and a cabinet and a parliament sort of thing, except they don't control the army and navy, which are sort of under the emperor. And they sort of appoint their own leaders without any input from the prime minister. There's a question as to who actually has the power to make any significant decision.
You've got that exactly right. That was Grew's dilemma. An ambassador has to figure out where are the levers of power and influence. And in most countries, it's pretty easy. it's the despot, or it's the political leaders, or it's clear. In Japan, there were all these little centers of power, and they were all competing: the palace advisors, the emperor, the military, and the branches of the military were competing with each other. Then you had, the as you said, the cabinet, and then you had the parliament, or Diet, as it was called there. So and then all these right wing patriotic societies also had quite a say in how people were feeling about things. So Gru did his best, but it was a maze. It was kind of chaotic.
We're talking to Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador and the countdown to Pearl Harbor, focused on the ambassador Joseph Clark Gru in the run-up to war between Japan and the United States. If you have questions about that era, the lead-up to that war and to Pearl Harbor, which we commemorate today, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A big question here is, of course, I think, was war with Japan, or from Japan's perspective, was war with the United States inevitable? How did Joseph Clark Gru try to figure out as he navigated this complex situation?
Well, an ambassador's primary task is to maintain peace between his country and the host country. And that's what Gru put all of his energies into right up to the very end. And I mean the very end, the night before Pearl Harbor happened. He was still working for peace. So he spent 10 years trying to do it. Whether the question you asked at the beginning, was war inevitable, mm-hmm. is that's the $100,000 question, of course. Gru, he believed up to the end that it was not inevitable. But looking back on it now, it appears that there was nothing he could do to stop this wave of fanaticism. This group of right-wingers was determined to expand the imperial empire. Their egomania and their quest for power was immense, and Gru did everything he could to stop it. It looked like a few times there might have been a chance to avert it or to postpone it, but they were always overwhelmed in the end by the right-wing passion for expansion.
Now, of course, Gru, as ambassador, is navigating this tough situation in Japan. He's also looking over his shoulder at the State Department and the President and Washington, and sometimes frustrated by the messages he was getting from back home and that the Japanese public and leadership was getting from the United States. What kind of things did he see as making his job more difficult?
Well, if you want to talk about the State Department, he was a good soldier in his own self-description. So, and his job as an ambassador is to convey the policies of his country to the host government. He always did that. Behind the scenes, however, in his letters, in his diary, he was sometimes frustrated, as you said, because the U.S., in particular, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, could be intransigent. He could, his standards were so high, his ideals were so high that they made him inflexible sometimes. Whereas Gru, as a diplomat, is working on the art of compromise. And that means being flexible. So sometimes Gru's classical opinion.
Now, from time to time, Gru is warning, hey, war is definitely a possibility with Japan. But he's also encouraging, I think, if I'm reading you right, the American government not to do too much saber rattling and to be willing to negotiate and compromise. Can you talk about how he tried to thread that needle?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question. He tried to thread it by knowing what the pressure points were on both sides. An ambassador sort of in the middle. He's working in two directions, towards his government, towards the host government. So he's trying to gather information from both sides and then use that to figure out, where is my path? And he tried to do that with the Japanese in several ways. He kept things behind the scenes. That's sort of the definition of diplomacy, at least from Gru, by telling them, you need to stop doing some of the things you're doing, such as bombing American properties in Japan, taking over property. You need to stop doing that. You keep promising you will, and you don't. And if you don't stop, the American public is going to get angry, You think that they're a bunch of isolationists and pacifists who won't go to war, but I'm telling you, the sheepskin will come off and the lion will come roaring out and you'll be sorry. On the Japan side, on the American side, he was telling Hull, these people are fanatical and they are capable of sudden dramatic actions, and we need to try to figure out a way for them to save face, to be able to back off of some of the things they're doing so that we can find a path towards peace.
We're talking to author Steve Kemper about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, commemorating the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. This ambassador in Tokyo at the center of the story. You can join in with your questions for our guest about his research, his work on the run-up to World War II, U.S. involvement in World War II. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Steve Kemper on the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. We're talking about his new book. It's called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, centering around that ambassador, Joseph Clark Grew, his efforts to prevent World War II, or at least American involvement in it, a war with Japan in the Pacific. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Michael is with us in Mequon. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for the call. Very interesting topic. My understanding is that there was a document called the Tanaka Memorial that may have been published around 1928. That outlined the idea that Japan was destined to be the superior power in the Pacific, and that the U.S. was the primary blockage to attaining that goal. I've read that some historians have thought that that was a fictitious document, that it was written by perhaps British intelligence to help drive the U.S. In a direction against Japan. Do you have any insights into whether the Tanaka Memorial was real and did it have a significant effect on Japanese strategy?
Interesting question, Michael. Steve, there is a lot of historical controversy about this thing.
Well, I don't know much about that particular document, but I can tell you that the contents, as you describe them, were not made up by British intelligence. Those were just the facts as the Japanese believed them. They did think that they were destined for imperial glory in the Far East. They thought that they were destined to rule the Far East. They were the superior race in Asia, as Germany felt they were the superior race in Europe. They felt that the United States was the principal obstacle to that goal because Britain was on one knee in the war. France had been defeated. The Netherlands had been defeated. The only thing standing between them and taking over was, what is the United States going to do? And so that document is, it maybe is part of some conspiracy by some people, but I know for a fact that that's what was believed by most of the people in Japan.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Your book covers really a 10-year period when Drew becomes the ambassador to Japan up through Pearl Harbor. Let's move in a little closer. Now, November 3rd, 1941, about a month before the Pearl Harbor attack, Drew in a dispatch includes the line, "Armed conflict with the United States might come with dangerous and dramatic suddenness." Can you talk about that last month of scramble to prevent that armed conflict?
Well, this is interesting because there's sort of two streams going into it. There's what Grew sensed and knew from being in Japan, and his information, his informants, many of them had dried up because it had become very dangerous to come to the embassy. It had become very dangerous even to speak English on the streets or anywhere else. But he sensed what was happening because of the contacts that he had, which were still strong, to the cabinet and the palace. On the other side, you had this program called MAGIC. We had decrypted the diplomatic traffic, Japan's diplomatic code, so that FDR and Hull knew exactly what was going back and forth between Tokyo and Washington, Tokyo and Berlin. They knew what the Japanese were planning, and that was also two-pronged. On the one hand, they were continuing to negotiate, and on the other side, they made clear they were planning for war, and both those things were in the diplomatic cables that Hull and FDR were reading. So as we got about the early November, the date had been set, and there wasn't much that anybody could do. There was the military had agreed that if by some miracle the United States will give us everything that we want, then we're not going to attack. But meanwhile, you diplomats keep talking. And they started to move troops, and we were aware of that troop movement. But of course, it's not like today. We just had sporadic reports about it. We didn't have any good, hard information about it. So that on the night before Pearl Harbor, for instance, FDR sent a cable directly to Hirohito through GRU. He was instructed GRU to deliver it, saying, "We are the leaders of our nations. It looks like your nation is heading towards a plan for war. I hope that we as the leaders can stop this, because it would be terrible for both of our countries." And GRU delivered that at midnight to the foreign minister the night before Pearl Harbor. The foreign minister knew it was too late. He knew that you know, this was a dead letter, essentially. He took that cable. He said he would deliver it. The next morning, GRU got up, and he had a message to come see the foreign minister right away. So he dressed, went over there. The foreign minister handed him some papers saying we're breaking off negotiations. That's all he said. And GRU thought, being the optimist that he was, well, I'll work on this in a few days. He went home, put on his golfing togs to go play golf. And then you heard the newsboys in the street crying, "War is declared. Japan has bombed Pearl Harbor." So that's how GRU found out about it. It was a very intense few weeks beforehand. And I'm leaving a lot out, of course, condensing a lot here.
Sure. We are talking about the career of American Ambassador Joseph Clark GRU. Our guest is Steve Kemper, author of the book Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. On this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack. Let's bring on another caller now. Brad is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Brad, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Well, I was curious. He brought up the primary, basically the primary duty of any ambassador is to keep peace with the nation that they're assigned to as ambassador. So if he had been successful in his duties and Japan had never attacked Pearl Harbor, what may have brought the United States into war with Japan, you know, aside from that, and where would we be today? Where would China be, who, you know, Japan had invaded and was, you know, to my knowledge, faring fairly poorly against them, you know, before the United States got involved and took a lot of Japan's war resources.
Brad, I gotcha. Thanks for the question. Steve, I don't know if we can get up to the present day, but absent that attack, I mean, a lot of people viewed on both sides the situation in the Pacific and the, you know, Japanese occupation of much of China and elsewhere as an unacceptable state of affairs. Putting off the Pearl Harbor attack, would it have really guaranteed peace for that much longer?
I doubt it. It's one of those hypotheticals that you never know. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, Japan seemed determined to expand. The United States was determined that that would not happen, at least not without limits. The United States had been very patient and had tried many, many different avenues to shore up or maintain or, you know, challenge Japan to stop in order before things got out of hand. Nothing worked. Nothing. Nothing from Washington. Nothing from GRU. So I don't know. I'm afraid it seems kind of inevitable.
Thanks for that question. I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath for Ambassador GRU and his staff. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. In effect, GRU and the American embassy are almost prisoners as much as they are diplomats at that point. Can you talk about the journey from the Pearl Harbor attack to them returning to New York?
Sure. Of course, after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, GRU and his staff were actually no longer diplomats. They had no contact with the Japanese government. They were just interned. They were prisoners of war inside the embassy. That lasted for 6 months as both sides negotiated the release of their respective diplomatic corps. In that 6 months, Gru wrote what he called his final report from Japan, which he was his analysis of what had happened and why. It was 277 pages long or something like that. When he got back to the U.S., he gave it to Secretary of Hull straight away, and with the gist of it, Hull looked through it and threw it back across the desk at Gru and told him to destroy every copy he had of it. So Gru did put it in his papers at Harvard, but he noted that 133 pages had been eliminated. And he also left in, though, a cover letter that he had written while he was on the ship coming back, a cover letter to FDR, 13 pages. And that's still in the archive. And when he refers in that letter to his final report, there's a Gru's little handwritten note saying, destroyed at Mr. Hull's request, which when you're a researcher, that's an exquisite little find, because it's Gru saying there was a crime committed here and I'm not going to cover it up.
And it's got to be tantalizing and frustrating for you as a researcher, knowing that it existed at one point and probably doesn't.
Well, that's sort of the takeoff point of my book, because the issue is Gru wanted to know, could we have done anything different? That was Gru's pressing question for himself and for his government. And so it became mine for my book. And you can find Gru's answer to it in all of his letters. He wrote so many letters, 6,000 pages of his diary just in Tokyo, and all of his dispatches back and forth. So if you dig through everything, you begin to get a sense like something arising out of the stone. There is an image that comes to the surface.
Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That's Steve Kemper. We talked to him about his new book, Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor, on this, the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks.